Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 416 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 8th of February, 2019, as I record this on a super windy day in Bath. And you might just hear that wind in my chimney as I record this. So today I'm talking about how to be a successful horror writer with Ian Rob Wright. But we're not just talking about horror. So the first half is really about horror. And then the second half is all about what it takes to make a full-time living as an indie author. So even if you don't write horror, you will definitely find this interesting. You can always skip through to the second half. But it's always fascinating to talk to people who are deep in their genre, because so many of us, me included, end up writing in multiple genres, and that can make it harder to make a living just with book sales. So Ian has gone really quite deep and talks about financial security when you stick with one genre, and also persistence for long-term success. So that is coming up. In publishing news this week, a bigger news story in the media space that is related to some of the audio and the voice stuff that I've been talking about recently. Quote, headline from The Guardian, "Future of digital journalism in question as BuzzFeed and HuffPost lay off 1,000 employees." So this is an interesting story, and it goes in to say that revenue was expected from ad sales. So if you're a text-based publisher, then the revenue through ads has actually not gone the way of expectations, and that ad revenue has gone to Google, Facebook, and of course, Amazon. Now, this is, I think, really interesting, because I know bloggers, for example, who have used ads on their sites, and I never did ads like that, as in I didn't have a little, you know, banner or whatever text. I don't do banner ads or text-based ads, and have instead gone down this sort of more personal brand-based relationship advertising model. And this is really interesting, because they're essentially saying that, it says, if you're hunting scale and revenue growth through hiring people to write content, this is not a sensible strategy. And I think this is very interesting for a lot of writers. If you are a freelance writer, then diversifying your revenue streams is a very good idea. And as I've been talking about, getting into voice is a really good idea because of the other story that has come out this week, which is Spotify has bought podcast network Gimlet Media and also Anchor, which is a startup that makes it easier to produce podcasts. And in fact, I am looking at Anchor for my new podcast, which is launching in March, and I'll talk about that in my personal segment in a minute. But really interesting to think about growth in sites that are audio based. Obviously, Spotify, incredibly successful company, Gimlet Media, very successful podcast network, and this is them doubling down in podcasting. You can see from Audible that they're doing a lot more audio first content, podcast type material, as well as audiobooks. So I think, you know, as I've talked about and will continue to talk about, is the future audio first? Well, it may well be. So I think my new website will be podcast driven. It will be podcast first. There will be text articles, but I will be doing voice as my primary medium. Another interesting thing is that Google announced Live Transcribe this week, an app that takes real-world speech and turns it into real-time captions using just the phone's microphone. And it's designed for accessibility to help hard-of-hearing or deaf people, but it's also clearly a leap forward in terms of speech recognition because it's real-time captioning and presumably will be available to help with dictation. All of this development of voice recognition, speech to text. This is all just fascinating to me. And this is only available on the Play Store, the Google Play Store, and also on Google Pixel devices. So this is not iOS or any other type of mobile or device. So yeah, really interesting there. Google is doing so much with voice. It's really fascinating. In my personal update this week, I had a couple of days off in London seeing friends, and as ever, I put my pictures on Instagram at jfpenauthor, and I have actually started writing the next Matt Walker novel. So I'm still trying to decide on the title, but it is around 5,000 words in right now, so really in the early stages. And I'm generally bouncing around. These first sort of 10, 20,000 words for me are very much investigative writing. I definitely don't sort of plan or plot very much. I write into the, I have a couple of things in my head, but I'm mainly a sort of write into the dark writer, a pantser as such. And I know that I could do better with my creative process, but I enjoy the exploration of writing. And what is interesting is in the past, my books that are in a series, and so my Arcane books, and there's 10 of those, and also my London crime thrillers, the 3 of those, each of those has been in a series, but it's kind of been, you can read them as a standalone book. Whereas this is definitely a book two, because I left some open things, and we're kind of in the world of the Matt Walkers now, whereas in book one, they were discovering that world. So it is a really interesting sense to write a book two, and knowing that people are going to have to read book one in order to really get it. And that's interesting. I have been delving into a lot of my travel stuff. We have a lockup because we have quite a small flat. We have a lockup with tax documents and old diaries and photos and things. So I went and picked up some of my old diaries, and I've been working on my new site and the preparation for my new podcast, which I will be launching in March. And I am really sharing a lot of what drives my writing. A lot of things that have ended up in my books will eventually end up in a travel memoir, in the shadow book, which I'm thinking about again, as well as more fiction. And I'm just loving it. I'm really loving it. I'm also putting a lot of my photos on this new site and sharing things that I haven't talked about before. The first podcast will be the 3 journeys that shaped the direction of my life. I'll also be doing one on what travel really means, as well as interviewing authors about the places that inspire their writing. So yeah, that is coming next month, but I'm starting to prepare it so that there's a stack of content there when I finally announce the URL. I've also been facing, this week I've had that massive self-doubt moment, not just a moment, a couple of days of chronic self-doubt, that feeling that I can't write another book, that I am really bad at writing. Why do I even bother trying? I have comparisonitis. I have fear of failure. I have fear of judgment. I have fear of putting myself out there. Lots of fear, lots of self-doubt. So I wanted to tell you all that, because what I do is get out my own copy of The Successful Author Mindset and read my own words. I go to the chapters that I feel and I read my own words and give myself a talking to. And of course, that is available in audio format too, if you need that in your ear. And it's so funny how this creative cycle works, because I know that this feeling will dissipate. In fact, it already is, as I have written today. I'd kind of just been writing notes and thoughts, and then today I actually wrote a chapter with different scenes in, and my different characters, they're starting to come alive again. So I know that this will dissipate as I get words on the page, but I just wanted to remind you all that these cycles don't go away, and you have to just learn your creative process and trust that it will come around again. Trust emergence, as I have written on my wall. Also, in exciting audio news, so I know I've been talking about it for ages, but finally, the three short stories that I have recorded, A Thousand Fiendish Angels, which is the collection, it's based on Dante's Inferno, and I have recently rewritten that, recorded it for audio. It's now in hardback, paperback, ebook, large print, and obviously audiobook. It's only 90 minutes, but I think it's probably the most expensive 90 minutes of work I've ever done because of the amount of time, the amount of training I've been doing, the number of times I've recorded the material, as well as the wonderful Dan doing the mastering. And just basically, I'm really proud of it. And again, I guess I'm a little bit, I have a little fear of judgment, but I am really proud of it. So I understand that with audio, it's not just, it's the author's voice, as in the written words are our voice, but also it's the voice of the narrator. And this is the first piece of fiction where the author's voice is also the author's voice for me. And I'm pretty thrilled about it. So if you fancy checking out me reading you some dark short stories, and they're not, I mean, they're not, they have an edge of horror, but they're certainly not gore fest or anything, then check out A Thousand Fiendish Angels, out now on all the usual places. And it is wide, so it will also be on Google Play and other places. And this is definitely a turning point for me. As I've talked about this year, I'm doing much more audio fiction. So I'll be doing The Dark Queen next, which is another standalone short story. Short stories are kind of easy to practice on because you have a finish point that you can see. Then I will be starting on Map of Shadows, the first Matt Walker book, with the aim that I will record book one as I write book two, and then also record book two, and with the aim, I think, that I will release everything together, so all the different formats together. I'll definitely have to hold off book two for that reason, but I think it will be worth it because of the marketing and interview coming up with Will from Findaway Voices, and he does say that one of the best ways to market audiobooks is to do simultaneous release. So very interesting times. Also, I got Business for Authors back from Exclusive Distribution. So this is a point worth noting. If you have gone exclusive with ACX for the 7 years, but you own the rights, as in you're not doing a royalty share, then you can get them back after 1 year and move into the non-exclusive model. So that's what I've done for Business for Authors. So that is going wide now through Findaway. And I'm really excited about getting my audio into libraries, Google Play, Storytel, and some of the other wide audio possibilities. Many of you have emailed me and cannot find my audio in libraries. And this is part of the reason. It's because I have been within the Amazon ecosystem. And it does annoy me now. And I remember people telling me that this would be so. But there is a point in our author journey when we can't necessarily afford to produce paid audio. And when I started doing audio back in, must be 2014 now, that, well, ACX wasn't even available in the UK. I used an American publisher. And so I'm locked into various royalty share and exclusivity deals. But I will just wait my 7 years and then I will get my rights back and I will do those again. But for now, I am fully in with wide audio, with getting into narration myself, and yeah, very excited about all of that. So yeah, check out A Thousand Fiendish Angels if you would like to hear JF Penn, my dark side, reading you some stories. In useful stuff today, Vellum has just released their update and have talked about this before, but finally it has been released thanks to many of you lot who requested large print formatting. Large print is now available through Vellum, so you can make your large print books. They also have options for mass market paperback, which apparently has been highly requested in the US. It's not a format we use here in Britain, but interesting. And I remember Dean Wesley-Smith talking about about this. So mass market paperbacks, on, you know, you can do them now as an indie, you can do large print. And there's also the A format and B format sizes used elsewhere in the here in the UK and other places. So new trim sizes for everything. And Vellum says, select the option. So say, for example, select large print, and Vellum will configure font size, line spacing, margins, etc. And I have a tutorial on how to use Vellum. I'll link to that in the show notes. It really is a fantastic piece of software. Also, we are truly into the year properly when I start doing webinars. And it's funny because every year I'm like, oh, webinars, it's tough. You know, it's I find them quite hard work because I always do them in my evening because obviously I'm ahead of the US and I'm quite tired and I worry about them. And sometimes the tech doesn't work and then I have like a heart attack. I literally have heart palpitations because I'm so worried about the tech. So I'm always resistant, but then so many of you find that webinars useful. So we are doing a webinar with ConvertKit. Now, lots of you found the interview with Tammy Labreck really useful. So email marketing clearly is a big buzzword still. I mean, we all know we need to do email marketing, but how do you do it in the most effective way? So Tammy gave you lots of tips on content, but this is a tips, but also technical setup webinar with ConvertKit. So I've been with ConvertKit for a couple of years now. Love ConvertKit. I've used a number of other systems and I find ConvertKit the easiest to use and also almost enjoyable. So we are doing a webinar on how to use email marketing to sell more books with ideas from various authors, including me, and also how to set up on your own, plus some special deals, obviously. And I'll be doing this with the lovely Issa Adney. And if you were on the webinar or you saw the webinar with Issa I did last year, we had an awesome time. She is a live wire and it is a really fun webinar, which is why I'm happy to do it again. So we are doing it on Tuesday, 19th of February at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. You can register to attend live or you can get the replay at thecreativepen.com/feb19. That's thecreativepen.com/FEB19 and links in the show notes as ever. Hope you'll come and join me for that first webinar of the year. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. I always love to hear from you. You can tweet me at the Creative Pen with a double N. Coaching Volleyball said, oh, this is interesting, said, you've talked a lot about getting more into print. I've published 3 volleyball books since 2011, all print and digital, all priced so each version nets the same revenue. Print has outsold ebooks almost 2.5 times to 1. Thought you'd find that interesting. And indeed, I think nonfiction always sells well in print. I sell a lot of print nonfiction. Also, surprisingly, surprising number of large print romance, as I've mentioned before. Christine Bernard says, great morning walk with the podcast. I've come back inspired and ready to write. Brilliant. Xander Griffiths says, listening to an episode about list building on the way to the coffee shop to write my automated email sequence. Well done, Xander. And a comment from Tammy Labreck, who says, I was pretty sure I'd reached complete saturation, but the Creative Pen podcast gave me a whole new lease on life, by which I mean, thanks for all the sales, Joanna. And I love this because it's total proof that podcast interviews sell books. Hear that, people. It's always worth trying to get on podcasts for book marketing, obviously in your niche. Just a couple more. C.R. Astle says, listening to the podcast with Tara McMullen while running home from work. Yay, healthy writer. As a slow writer trying to find the balance between job, health, social life, I was interested in the discussion on launch cycles. Fantastic. really exciting. Also, just wanted to mention Lindsay Baroka, friend and prolific author. Hi, Lindsay. Says, this was an example of different strokes for different folks, talking about the interview with Tara. I am a fan of the launch process, and working hard for a couple of weeks around the release and then taking time off afterwards. The same with finishing a book. I work hard to get it done and then do fun stuff while completely ignoring email and work, at least for a few days. It's the daily grind that makes people burn out. Email every day, social media every day, checking ads every day. And absolutely, I agree with Lindsay there. I definitely do these sort of cycles. I used to be a management consultant back in the day, and it was all about project deadline. So we would work to a project, we would go live, and then we would take some time off or collapse, get sick, etc. And I do find this sort of project process is a good thing. Hence why I was in London for a couple of days, catching up with friends, having a few drinks, eating nice food, etc. in between, before starting my next book. And also thanks to Billy Joe, who ordered my London psychic crime thriller series at her local library in St. Paul, MN. I don't know what state that is. Montana? Massachusetts? Oh, you Americans are laughing at me now. I should look it up, but I'm in the middle of recording. MN. Anyway, Billy Joe requested that they buy it. Thank you very much. And she says, they appreciate it when I give them ISBNs for the ease of ordering. They want to purchase more indie authors, but rely on Patreon or customer requests. So that's a great tip from Billy Joe. Definitely get your author friends to order your books into libraries. Brilliant. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I will play a word from them in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, the transcription, the editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by wonderful patrons on Patreon, and you know I love you all. And thanks to everyone who's been supporting the show for years now, and also new patrons this week, Shannon Yun, Sarah Rockwood, Sarah Beth Hunt, Nicole Ayres, Robin Harford, Dave Davis, Lance Wantanar, Bjorn Bauman, H.B. Line, and A. Whelan, which just all that is fantastic. I really appreciate your support on Patreon, like your tweets and emails and everything, buying my courses and my books. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, you can give a couple of dollars a month and you'll get extra audio, extra 45 minutes audio every month, and the whole backlist. So if you would like a ton more audio with me giving you advice and laughing, then check out Patreon at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners, I'm Chrissy.
And I'm Stephanie.
And we are from the Kobo Writing Life team, and we are also the co-hosts of the Kobo Writing Life podcast, where we have been learning a lot of great wisdom on recent episodes especially, so we thought we would summarize the top tips for you.
So in episode 130, we interviewed author Signe Pike, who wrote The Lost Queen, and so her top tip was to find a specific physical place where you can consistently write. Putting your body in that space will help form the habit of jumping right back into your story.
I love that advice. And on episode 135, we focused on the extremely important topic of accessibility in EPUBs. We talked to an in-house expert, Wendy Reed, who is a Kobo senior QA analyst, and her advice was to include image alt text in your EPUB when you include images in your ebooks. Also, if you're not the one creating your EPUBs, ask whoever is to be sure that they include EPUB accessibility features. That episode is jam-packed with great info, and I think it's a must-listen for any author.
And then some advice from our KWL operations team. So instead of putting your series information in your subtitle, include it in the series name and number text fields only when you set up your books on Kobo Writing Life. This will automatically link your titles on site.
We've been really happy with the awesome guests we're getting on the Kobo Writing Life podcast. You can grab it anywhere that you listen to your podcasts. And if you're not already publishing with us, we hope you'll check out the Kobo Writing Life platform for free. It's kobo.com/writinglife. Thanks as always for listening, and we'll hand it back over to you, Joanna.
today, I'm here with Ian Robb-Wright. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Joanna. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great for you to be here. So just a little introduction. Ian is the best-selling British author of over 20 horror novels in a number of subgenres, including the apocalyptic novels The Final Winter and The Gates. And we went full-time as indies around the same time, although we've never met, which is kind of crazy in person. But just start out. Tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing.
I've always sort of enjoyed writing. I think that's true of most authors or hobbyists or whatever. We enjoy the act of writing. So, you know, even as a child at school, I always enjoyed English and writing little stories and things. So I always had that desire in me. As for how I, you know, got into being an actual author, I went almost completely the indie route, and that was basically out of desperation to start earning money from my work, because I'd been doing sales for 5 or 6 years in the phone industry, and I was really unhappy and getting worse and worse with sort of not enjoying the job. And eventually one day I just had enough and I walked out on a job. I was working for the Three Network at the time. So I just completely walked out, but I'd had this book I'd been writing in my spare time just as a hobby. And I had the same dream of, you know, oh, one day I'm going to get an agent and be published, and they had the artist and writer's handbook like everybody did back then. But I also knew, you know, it's a bit of a lottery win. It isn't an easy thing. And it was in a time when you'd say, oh, I want to be a writer one day, and people just go, yeah, okay, good luck with that. But I was desperate. So, you know, I had my partner at the time, who's now my wife, you know, she wasn't very happy. I just walked out on my job. But I promised her, you know, I've got this book and I'm going to get an agent and all this. And I started researching agents, and somehow I must have stumbled across KDP. And this was in 2011. It was in the May. So I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a great success. Wonderful. You know, this is all I need to never have to go back to working in phones. Like, completely deluding myself at the time. But I published it and it started to make a little bit of money. And I was like, oh, that's nice. And so my partner said, look, I'll give you 6 months. If you can replace the income you were making in sales, then, you know, that's great. Stay at home. And at the time I was kind of half paying my way by being an at-home guy doing all the washing and the cleaning to try and, you know, make myself useful and just banking on this book. And in month six exactly, which was the deadline, it made the exact same amount I'd been making in sales in month six. So it did exactly, you know, what I'd hoped it would do. But it was like winning the lottery, because I didn't do anything, you know, proactive. I put it out there, went on Facebook, you know, I didn't even have a Facebook up until that point, just shouted about it a bit, and, you know, and it took off, and I was earning, you know, thousands of pounds a month from this one book. And that was in 2011. And I think in hindsight now, I was so lucky that it was that point in time that I needed that break, because if I was in that situation now and had one book and just wanted a break into the industry and make a living, it's just so difficult now, and there's so many millions of ebooks that just weren't there in 2011. So I'm so blessed for the timing, and it is really difficult now to have that same sort of overnight success, but it is still possible. But it's much more of a long-term sort of business now that you need to set up to make it in self-publishing. Whereas there, to be honest, I was blessed and really lucky, as you know, I'm sure you found the earlier days were a little bit easier going. And you didn't have to sort of swim quite so hard to stay afloat. But
I think, I mean, maybe that's true in any industry. And we don't want to make anyone listening feel bad if they're just starting. Yeah. There's opportunity at any point. And also, absolutely. I think those of us, whenever you're starting something new, you've also got energy that you didn't have, you don't necessarily have later.
Yeah, no, there's so many different things I have to do now. Whereas in 2011, it was just pure. It was just, I've written a book and I want to sell it. And now it's so many other things. There's still guys that I see kind of getting success really fast, but there's no kind of easy wins now, I think. And I like the fact that self-publishing, it's become a little bit more mature and serious, and that the people that are going to make it are the ones that deserve it and work hard and work smart. You know, some of the ones that were kind of chances or had some success and didn't necessarily deserve, they've kind of fallen by the wayside a bit now. So I suppose it's matured like any other business, that, you know, the success is going to go to those who work hard and work smart.
Yeah, which is a good news for everyone, because yeah. those people are listening to this show. So we're going to circle back to what you're doing now to be continually successful. But let's just wind it back to horror, because I also think that you perhaps were more visible in 2011 because the horror niche was not so busy as it is now. I mean, horror has really taken off. So let's just start by a lot of people put horror in the kind of slasher gore category and forget that it's a very broad church. So just give us an idea about, you know, what goes into horror at this point in time, and what type of subgenres do you personally write in?
I never really go into a horror novel with with horrific thoughts. It's more something of hope. It's very much like I've got these characters in a really desperate situation, and I think about how they're going to come out at the end of it, you know, stronger. And I think a lot of people kind of look down on horror as you know, exploitative and, you know, a little bit lowbrow. But I think horror is one of the most hopeful genres, because it's all about, you know, burying your characters in insurmountable odds, and then the human condition and, you know, the endeavor of your characters gets them through to the end and they come out a bit stronger. And, you know, whether it's they defeat some natural crisis, Mother Nature turning on them and, you know, the world ending, or whether it's, a killer in the woods, it's all about finding the inner strength of humanity. And I think that, you know, puts hope and strength onto the reader by showing them what people can achieve. And I think horror is one of the most ancient genres, and I think it should get more respect than it does, because I think it's very much the closest genre to, you know, what it is to be human. And whenever I write a horror novel, it's always the characters that are strongest in my mind rather than the villain or the scene, the horror. It's all about, you know, what I want to bring out of these characters and the adversity they face. So I find it a really uplifting genre to write, and then people would always expect me to be really, you know, I'm wearing black now, but usually I'm a happy person. You know, my favorite place in the world is Disney World. I love being at home with my kids. My office is covered in Disney. You know, there's no Freddy Krueger on the wall or anything like that. And I'm not, you know, a depressing person at all, because I find horror is a really nice place to kind of exist, because it's all about triumph and hope and strength. It's not about, you know, any of the bad things in humanity.
I'm definitely with you there. And it's funny, I love reading horror. I read a lot of horror, and I feel that it's about eventually something good will triumph over evil in most of the kind of genre. I mean, not all of them, but generally. And Jonathan Mabry, who I love, you know, great horror writer, says it's not about the monsters, it's about the people who win over the monsters in the end.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why Stephen King's so successful, because he's very character driven. And I think, you know, my favourite horror novels are the ones where, you know, the characters stood out to me so much. One of my favourite horror novels is World War Z. And that's almost because the zombies could be any sort of natural disaster, and it's all about the survivors and their tales and humanity getting through just a disaster that happens to be zombies. But I think, you know, the horror is at its strongest when it's character driven.
I love that book too. And when I saw you said that in another interview, and I think that's the book that got me into zombies, because I was like, I'm not going to read zombie stuff. And actually, that book, I would say, is literature, in that it's actually the book is so not the film, right? The film is whatever, dreadful. But the book, it's basically alternate history, I would say. So really, it's probably really, I mean, the fact that it has zombies in, but it's more speculative fiction. So this is sort of what I want to circle back to. So does horror always have to have something supernatural in? And where does it move into crime? You know, where crime can be a serial killer book is often a crime book. So where do the boundaries between horror and crime and thriller and paranormal, all of those go?
Yeah, I think, in the Venn diagram, the crossover for crime and horror is definitely the serial killer. And I think, you know, you've got also, you know, like the end of the world because of global warming and stuff can sort of be horror as well. And then, you know, you've got the sci-fi spectrum. So I think, you know, a lot of genres are interlinked. I think the only pure horror probably is supernatural, because that, you know, really only exists in horror or possibly fantasy. But, you know, all other types of horror, you know, They're just drawn from, you know, the scariness of humanity or Mother Nature. And I think horror is a pretty wide net, to be honest. And I think that's why there's so many subgenres in horror. I mean, if you take, you know, crime, you've got the cozy mystery and things. I don't think there's as many subgenres as there is with horror, because it goes into post-apocalypse and joins with sci-fi, and it goes into serial killers and joins with crime. So I think it's the centre of the universe, I do horror. And I think all the other genres gravitate around horror because it links with all of them, you know.
I love that. That's brilliant. I'm going to go with that. Horror is the center of the universe. But no, I do like that. And I mean, I like also what you said about being a happy person, because I'm a happy person and I read a lot of horror. I know a lot of horror writers, and I find horror writers some of the nicest people. I've said this before on the show. Yeah, because I think if everyone has a dark side, dark things in their head, and horror writers can get it out on the page, and thus it's not in their head anymore. Whereas, like, if you write like rainbows and unicorns, all the dark stuff stays in your brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is definitely a bit like that.
I've met a lot of horror authors and, you know, they're all great people. They're all lovely. We've all got great sense of humours.
okay, so let's just kind of staying with writing horror then. If people are interested in writing horror, I imagine they're reading a lot of horror, but there is some horror tropes that a reader would, you know, necessarily needs to have, and also some that might have turned into clichés. So what are some of those sort of necessary tropes and clichés?
I think it's a difficult one to answer, I suppose. I always try to think what fear comes from our human needs being sort of taken from us. So, you know, we don't like being trapped or confined because, you know, we worry about suffocating. We don't, you know, the end of the world situations with zombies and things, we fear about getting food and shelter and warmth. You know, we don't want to be attacked and things. So you have to kind of think about what human needs you're going to take away from your survivors, because that's where the sort of the fear comes from. So, you know, being stalked in the dark woods by, you know, a slasher, you know, you're losing your sight because you're in the dark and you're around the woods. So you're taking the sight from the character. So I think a lot of the tropes that, you know, are fundamental tends to be things about putting people in a situation where they can't fully focus on their comforts, you know, the things that would usually keep them safe. I suppose you revert their little patch of civilization back down to caveman era, and you bring out the inner caveman fears and things. So being chased, you know, that brings out our caveman, that, you know, we need to get away as quickly as possible. You know, being trapped, you know, is a primal fear. So I think the tropes that always tend to be necessary to bring out that fear in the reader, they need to be very primal, deep fears that we have. You know, like spiders terrify people because we have a primal fear of being bitten and, you know, poisoned and things. So the tropes tend to be very much around primal fears, I feel.
Mm. And then, like I read in one of your interviews, you said, you know, one of the cliches that to be avoided is the young blonde woman running and then tripping over a log or something. I'd actually put, you know, in general, the kind of young, beautiful person being murdered is a trope. I mean, it really it's a kind of, and this is repeated. So anything else people should be kind of avoiding or being aware of? Like, I think gender tropes in horror are quite important to challenge.
Absolutely. And I mean, with my own work, people quite often praise the fact that my characters are normal people, and they don't have any guns or training. They're not soldiers or police officers usually. You know, I've got, you know, salesmen that get into the horrible situations and things. And there's a website called tropes.org, I think. And I read that for every film or book I enjoy, and it will list out all the tropes and whether they've been subverted. But I mean, whenever you can identify a trope, it's really fun to try and do the opposite. So you've got, you know, I think Buffy the Vampire Slayer did it in the first scene of the series, where they had a blonde girl running and being chased by, you know, a lad, and then she suddenly turns into a vampire and kills him. And that was, you know, subverting a trope that at that point had been pretty steadfast with, you know, the slasher movies of the 80s and 90s. So Joss Whedon, you know, subverted that trope there. So I think you should look at whatever the zeitgeist is, you know, what what's the trope today, you know, what's happening today, and try and, you know, subvert that. And that can be really successful. And I know for a long time, you know, zombies kind of outstayed their welcome. So the more popular ones were ones like Jonathan Mabry. He did think, you know, he had Patient Zero that did the zombies, but it was very much scientific rather than, you know, the dead arising and nobody knows why. He went the opposite direction and meant the dead arising and this is why it's scientific and someone's doing it, a terrorist. And he subverted the tropes there. And I think at the moment we've got Bird Box and the one where they couldn't make a noise.
The Silent Place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, those are obviously the tropes at the moment. So if you can think of some cool way to subvert that, you'd kind of be tapping into what today's audience are looking for and then surprising them. But the tropes change all the time with every generation, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even I was thinking about the zombies, because I read quite a lot of zombie fiction. Well, I didn't used to. Again, Jonathan Mabry really got me into it. And he has like the Rotten Ruin series, which is a YA kind of crossover, which is in that. But also like Game of Thrones, has zombies in, you know, the whites and the army of the dead, they are zombies. But yet people don't, because they don't get called that, people almost forget that they're watching zombie kind of horror.
And that's what you got to do, because if you're just following the same old path, then people just roll their eyes. Because, you know, you'll get the most success when you do something first. And that's true in any life. Because, you know, you look at Mark Dawson, he got the most success from Facebook ads because he's the guy that twigged on it first. And it's the same for writing within a genre. If you have the idea first, it's completely fresh and original. And there's a book called Hex, and I forget the guy's name because it's hard to pronounce. But he wrote a story about a witch that's nothing like anything I've ever read. And it's stuck in my mind so much because there's nothing it can get lost within my head, because it stands on its own as this unique story that there's nothing else like, so I can't help but think about that. Whereas with zombie films and books, they become quite interchangeable unless they have something really specific. So any horror writer out there, well, I think we all have the same kind of desire that, oh, I want to write a zombie book, I want to write a haunted house book, I want to write a vampire book. Because we're fans of the genre, we want to do these things that we've enjoyed so much ourselves. But when you take that route, like, I want to write a vampire novel at some point, and what's putting me off is when I do, I want it to be completely different. And I love the Strain series of books because they're so different.
And I
took that with, when I did tackle zombies, I made sure I did some things different. And that's why I'm not going to write a vampire book until I have that idea. And I think one of the worst things, especially a horror author, can do is just go, I love zombies, so I'm going to write a zombie book, because there's so many. So you've got to think, I'm going to write a zombie book, but this is how it's completely different from every other zombie book. And you can't, with so many books available now, you kind of need to have that unique selling point, I think. If you're looking at, you know, making money and a living, you need to have that.
So thinking about sort of how that, you know, you mentioned Bird Box, which, you know, has been on Netflix, the adaptation, and many of us read the book Josh Malerman a couple of years ago now, I guess, when it came out. So, you know, and given Stranger Things, again, Netflix, a lot of Amazon stuff coming out and films, horror stuff just being more mainstream, do you think even writing screenplays or trying to do adaptations or looking at other forms of media is a good way forward for horror? What are your thoughts around this for yourself?
I think there's going to be a bit of a renaissance with these streaming platforms that give us, just like Kindle gave us, unprecedented ability to publish our books. I think, you know, you can contact Netflix and they'll get back to you. You can't contact MGM and hope to have someone get back to you. I mean, I've got a friend, Matt Shaw, who's been dealing with Netflix about having a small indie film he made put on there, and they're receptive to it. And with Amazon, because you've got Thomas and Mercer and 47 North, because there's a good route now where you can start out on publishing your own books on Kindle and try and kill it with sales, so much so that Amazon take notice and then get you onto one of their imprints. And then if that does really well, they're already set up to do an Amazon Prime show based on one of the books. So there's a direct route now for Joe Bloggs to write a book and someday get, you know, onto Amazon Prime or Netflix, because it's all kind of being streamlined around sort of, you know, it's very much between the viewer now and the creator, with a lot less in the middle, which is great. Mm. You know, and booksellers would say the opposite, that it's not great, and agents and all that would say it's not great. But for us, the creators, it is, because there's less resistance now to get to that end point. And, you know, I wrote a horror script for Audible to make a standalone sort of horror play, and I wrote that. They paid me for it, and I haven't heard anything since, but it happened. They got in touch with me. You know, I'm not with an agent or a big, you know, publishing deal, but Audible came to me and said, look, you know, I'd really like you to write some horror for our platform exclusively. And, you know, that happened, and I've had a board game manufacturer contact me to make a board game. And if you concentrate now on just selling your book, everything else kind of falls in around you. And that's great, because there's less to worry about, and you can only focus on what you can do. So you don't have to worry about trying to get an agent and trying to win the lottery of getting that, you know, and then hope that agent can get into it. Like, there's a lot less just hoping on this happening and hoping on that happening. You write your books, you try and sell them as good as you can, and that success will breed success, you know. And you look at Mark Dawson, I know he's got all sorts of things in the pipeline, but it all began with him finding out how to sell his own books. So my advice for authors is always concentrate on that, and, you know, the rest will come. The best way to get a film deal or a book deal is to sell a million ebooks, you know, and you have control over that. You can change that, but you can't make a Hollywood, you know, executive take note of you. That's not something you can just go out and do.
It's funny. I mean, I have obviously looked at the way you're doing things, and I admire you very much. And actually, similar to Mark Dawson, you're very focused, which is fantastic. And, you know, I have a different brain, which is I'm kind of, you know, I'm interested in so many things, and I do so many different things, and I don't focus. Now, some people would say, you know, that is just a fundamental difference in personality. And I, you know, I like having a wide base because it feels more stable to me. But how you're doing things, obviously you're very successful. You never went back to the day job, right?
Basically. Seven years now, going on 8 years. I've never worked for anyone else.
So basically, similar time to me. So tell us, how are you running things right now? How are you managing to make a good full-time living, supporting your family beginning of 2019 as we record this?
Well, I'll tell you one of the reasons I am so focused. There was a point, and I think, I suppose when I think of things as a business, this is actually something that happens to a lot of businesses that start to get success. I suddenly branched out in 100 directions, thinking that was what I needed to do. Diversify, don't get all my income from Amazon. So I set up an online course. I was going to try and sell products and t-shirts. And I started to do all that, and they were all making little bits of income. But slowly my sanity just started slipping, and I was depressed, and I had the online course, but I didn't feel right trying to get hundreds of pounds out of fellow authors, because I kind of have an overactive cringe gland, and and what I really love about selling books is that it's so passive. Suddenly I was in this direct sales, atmosphere, and that was making me feel really depressed. And I felt guilty, like I was charging people for something that wasn't worth the money, and all these things. And I'm a pretty anxious person and a deep thinker, and it wasn't making me happy. So I decided I'm going to draw it back down to books. You know, I'm going to focus on the one thing that I am good at and that I enjoy. And my wife just recently left her job. She was an MD of a company, but, you know, she was working every hour God sent and missing out on our kids. And I was kind of becoming a main breadwinner / at home daddy as well. So I was getting stressed and overworked. So my wife now is come home, and we're going to, you know, try and build the business together now and do some of the things I wanted to do. But I was a bit overwhelmed, and she's very, very much a stronger person than me emotionally, that you can put the weight of the world on her, and she'll come out smelling of roses, whereas I will crumple. So it's really good to now have her kind of at home with me to deal with those things. But from what I do personally to, you know, stay afloat and do well, first thing is I haven't panicked over the last 7 years. The first time Kindle Unlimited came along and used to pay you per download rather than length and all things like that, destroyed me, wiped out half my sales almost overnight. And suddenly, you know, there was these guys with 100 short stories were making more than me, who'd written, you know, 15 full length novels that I tried to, you know, take very seriously. So that ruined me almost and made me panic and think, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I reacted to the environment. I wrote a load of short stories, put them together in a compendium, released them separately, started to take advantage of the new model. that got my earnings up a bit more, but I concentrated on doing the right thing. So I concentrated on keep getting people onto my mailing list and just kind of steadying the ship a bit. And I didn't think short term. I just kept going, doing the right things. And those people that suddenly had this boom with Kindle Unlimited taking advantage of it, they're getting day jobs again now. And I feel really bad for them. But it's quite a few of my colleagues who started in 2011 or thereabouts that did really well. You know, they spent all their money, posted it all over Facebook, they're doing all this, that and the other, you know, and just kept writing books and not thinking about anything else, just thinking it'll always be this way and it won't. It's going to get harder, it's going to get easier, wages go up, wages go down. And that's business. You have to, I'm always reading things you've written, David Goffin's written, Mark's written, you know, I take online courses and I always make sure I know what's declining and what's on the rise. And I try to dabble in them all to see what's helping. And I never stay static, and you can't. If I just sat and wrote books and kept releasing them like I did in 2011, I'd be back at a day job, because it takes a lot more than that now. And I think to give a few tips people can take away, you got to have that reader magnet on your website and people signing up to your mailing list. It's just fundamental. And that's what gives you the stability. If Amazon stops selling books tomorrow, I know I've got 20,000 people, I can try and migrate somewhere else. You've got to have that little bit of control, because that gives you the stability for when times are down, so that, you know, you can make hay sometimes when things are good, but you need a cushion to keep a baseline. And that's what a mailing list will do for you. It'll keep you at that level of never being completely out of ideas and never having zero sales. So that's fundamental. As soon as you've got two books, start giving away book one for free, and selling them book two. And you know that I give away five free books because I'm in a position I can do that, but it pays for itself and it always will do. You know, and it's, although I hate to say it, at the moment advertising, it's the difference maker. I was doing pretty well. I was earning, you know, between £3,000 and £5,000 a month in pounds, which is a good living. Once I started getting the ads working for me, you know, I'm £20,000 of sales some months and things, it completely took me from plodding along to, you know, wow, this has changed my life on a whole new level. So, I mean, to get established and to kind of stay afloat, the mailing list will probably be enough if you're doing everything right and you're writing good books and you're writing them quick enough and you're releasing them to a mailing list. You can probably plod along like that. But if you really want to, you know, make a name for yourself, even at a low level, you kind of need to dabble with the ads, I think, because it's the way the industry's grown. And it's because it's becoming like any other business. You've got to, you know, fight for that visibility.
Absolutely. No, I agree with all of that. Do you think also that, have you focused down on specific subgenres and you're kind of writing to an audience?
Yeah. And again, that's kind of, financial security does come from sticking in the same genre. I wrote, you know, probably a dozen horror novels, and then I released an action thriller and it just died a death. No one was interested and it was like starting again. So it is easy if you stick to one genre because you can keep building within that genre. But then, you know, as an author, we are, I suppose, artists, and we do need to flex our muscles sometimes and write something different. So you can do that. Just be prepared that it's almost like starting again. So make sure you're in a position where, okay, money's quite good, sales quite good, I can probably afford to take a hit for a few months by building up, you know, some new books. And my Sarah Stone thrillers languished for a long time, doing absolutely nothing until I started advertising them. And now they make a lot of money. And that completely changed from no sales whatsoever to being really popular. And that was 100% advertising, because it just wasn't happening without the Facebook ads. But with my horror novels, you know, I can sell them without ads because I've got, you know, 20,000 horror fans on my mailing list. And if I try to sell them a romance book, not a single one would buy it. So you need to kind of, if you are going to go multi-genre, you need to almost run separate businesses. So you can't have a mailing list that's going to do every genre. You'd have to set up, you know, history, fiction and romance and horror, you know, and for each one, when it is a separate business, maybe have a different pen name, because you know, you can't just flog everything to the same audience. You need to sell them what they want from you.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, that's why I have two, although within JF Pen I do write a number of subgenres, so it's kind of difficult. You might, you know, I might end up having different lists with different subgenres. But you've mentioned Facebook ads and Amazon ads, so are you using both right now or either?
Facebook ads, since for the probably 12 months ago, last January, I started again. I tried it originally when Mark first released his course. I took it, and the sign-ups to my mailing list work straight away, and they always have done. So I can add subscribers between 30 and 50 pence, and with, you know, a catalogue of 20 odd books, that is worth doing. It makes me money. So that worked from day one, but I could not get any traction on paid sales. So if I advertised the box set and tried to sell it there and then, it was losing me money. So I gave that up for probably 18 months. I just didn't touch it. And then for some reason, I can't even remember what it was now. I think sales were a bit down. I knew my wife was unhappy in her job, so she didn't want to be there anymore. And that was a big wage. She wanted to give up. So I got a bit desperate again. And I think a lot of my success comes when I'm really desperate and down. And that's when I kind of come out the gates fighting. So I spent a load of money on Facebook ads, but this time I targeted people with the caveat that they had to own a Kindle. So I targeted Stephen King fans, but narrowed it to only Kindle owners. And suddenly I did a 10 grand month out of nowhere. Having the previous month, I did about 3.5. It had been a pretty bad month. I know 3.5, you know, is a lot of money for most people that want to write. But for me, that was kind of at the low end of what I was earning. So that wasn't great. And then suddenly I did about 10 grand's worth of sales. And, you know, most of that was profit. I'd only spent about 2 grand to get that boost. So I was like, whoa, what just happened there? So then next month I ran even more ads and I went over 20 grand in sales and I kept doing that. And made, you know, stupid amounts. I've made more in the last 12 months than I ever have done in the last 7. And that was because for me, the Facebook ads suddenly just clicked I spent all the money I had on my business credit card and things and just spent whatever capital I had. And that was what stopped me from spending more. I had no more money to spend. And I got all that back, plus, you know, a return on investment. And then things started to die down a bit. So I think what I learned is you can't get those gains forever. So you can definitely get that for a bit, but don't think that's going to, you know, I can't keep doing 20 grand months, unfortunately. But I've now got to a point where, you know, I am boosting my sales to a really good level and keeping them there. And I think that's, you know, that's what advertising will do for you, slip away into obscurity. So I'm spending probably 5-6 grand a month on Facebook at the moment and making about, you know, 15 to 20 in sales. So it's a really good living. Amazon ads, I'm really struggling with. And actually, I've had a recommendation of an agency from a pretty big author who's doing really well. And they're going to start managing my AMS ads in April and doing it all for me for a fee. So I'm going to test that for a few months and see whether they manage to pay for themselves. So I don't usually outsource things. I usually like to do them myself, but I just can't seem to get anything to happen with AMS. So I'm going to outsource that. But Facebook ads, the better you can get at that, the better. Because even if you're only spending, you know, $5 a day, you can make a profit on that and then just scale it up. So there's a pretty low entry point to get into it. And then if you do get better at it, because of the returns you're making, you can scale it up. Kind of, it pays for itself to scale up if you're doing it right. But it's just hard to get that initial success. It took me 18 months to finally get that working. So it's a skill in itself.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And just for everyone listening, you know, just because Facebook ads work for you doesn't mean they're going to work for someone else, and vice versa.
Don't spend a load of money.
Yeah, and also Amazon ads work for some people, don't work for other people. Absolutely. It's so interesting. So, and I think, again, you mentioned there, like, things, it's almost like you, something changes in your life, like your sales drop, or you have a family situation, and then you really push, and you're like pushing, and then you're like, what's the latest thing? And you're getting into that, and then you realize that's going to drop off. And this is so important, and this is why you're in it for the long term, and you have a mature business like me. So this works now, let's take advantage of it. It's stopped working, move, like, maybe do something else. So nothing ever continues to work in the same way, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a few things that I suppose you'd call them evergreen, and that's things like your mailing list, writing good books, having good covers, good blurbs, you know, those things don't change, so be good at those. Don't skimp on editing and artwork and things. But yeah, there's always fads that are working. And that's where you need to, if you were, you know, investing in stocks in London, you'd be reading the Financial Times and all, you know, the broadsheets and things, and you'd be reading business constantly immersing yourself in that world. And that's kind of what you have to do to take it beyond a hobby. You can't just write books and put them on KDP. You need to know what Mark Dawson's doing, Hugh Howey, you know, all the guys who are really good at learning this stuff. And you also need to try and find the things yourself as well by, doing your own little testing. But you can't be static. You need to know where the market is, where it's going, and just try new things. Because like I say, if you can twig on something first, you'll get the biggest gains, like, Mark Dawson and some of the early self-publishers that found the success when ebooks were, first a thing. So always try new things yourself as well. But you want to look at the juggernauts and see what's working for them, because it will usually work for you if you get in there early enough.
Absolutely. Okay, last question before we finish up. So I wanted to ask you about the Horror Writers Association. So we're both members mm-hmm. of that, and they've just released a long list for the Bram Stoker Award. And I find it really interesting that I feel like there's two things. One, I feel they're really open to indies. And on the other hand, I see mostly traditionally published authors in things like awards list. So yeah. This is kind of a broader question. It doesn't need to be specifically HWA, but how open do you think associations are, like professional ones at that level, to indies? And would you ever consider a traditional publishing deal in order to get into that type of prize area?
To be honest, I think they're all going to die a death and be replaced by, more forward-thinking ones. I've been a member of the HWA for 5 years. They accepted me as an active member because I'd earned $2,000 from an actual publisher. And that's about all they ever wrote me with a book that was with them. And I brought the rights back off them eventually and then 10 times more on my own. But what got me into the HWA as an active member was the fact they'd written me a check. So that legitimised me more to them that somebody else had written me a check than I actually went out and sold thousands of books on my own.
They have changed that because I got in as an indie.
Oh, right. Okay. So, back when I don't know what it is now because I joined so long ago, but I'm a member, but the interaction I've had, is pretty much zero. It's kind of in name only with me. And that's as much my fault as theirs, I suppose. I don't really get involved because... I don't know. I'm not big on vanity. I don't really care about awards. I don't care about, being lauded as anything but someone that entertains people and gives, £3 worth of value with a book or whatever. What matters to me is, the house my family live in and how much time I get to spend with them and, the lives, my family live based off what I do, which isn't just monetary. It's the fact that I'm at home all the time. I get to make my own hours and things. So those are the things that matter to me. And like a business, I want to make as much money as possible. So I don't really think about winning awards, but I think a lot of them, and not saying the HWA specifically, but they're just old boys clubs full of snobs that think they're better than, everybody else. And I don't really think they serve that much of a purpose. Like the HWA has never done anything to fight the cause for me, and I've never really done anything for them, and I've kind of got their membership, that kind of almost legitimizes me in some way. And to be honest, early on, that's kind of why I tried to get it, because I thought less of myself as an indie author. And I suppose now I've got the ego where I've sold more books than most traditionally published authors, especially in the horror genre, that I kind of just think, well, I don't want anything to do with traditional publishers, because I've been down to London several times to meet with, agents, or I've been down to meet Audible and ACX and things. And, the only ones that ever really have my interest are the ones that want to work with creators, and they don't care, whether there's an agent in between or not. And, when Audible brought me down to see them, they didn't care about any of that. And that's why Amazon are, they're the ones that are doing so well, while, proper publishers, as they'd call themselves, they're struggling. And that's why I think, there's the Alliance of Independent Authors actually tries to be a resource and, fight causes and things, whereas these awards, ceremony, they're all, nepotistic and things, and I don't really care, to be honest.
Oh, I love it.
You've asked me about something I don't really have much of an opinion on, I'll be honest.
Well, no, that is an opinion. That is a very valid opinion, because I do think that so much of the of what happens in your indie life is about the definition of success. Because if your definition of success is to get an agent and a publisher and a prize
and be broke,
but that's the thing. It's like, if you want to make moldy six figures, you know, or you know, six figure plus living, then you're doing that, and I'm doing that, and neither of us have those things. So I think that is a totally valid point, and I really appreciate that. So tell people where they can find you and your books online, and also you have a non-fiction book too, so mention that as well.
Yeah, I did. Sal, where's that Diary of a Flummoxed Father? I thought it was in the kitchen. I do. I've just written my first non-fiction book, and it's all about my experiences of having my first child, Jack. It's tongue-in-cheek comedy. It's a bit sort of Dave Gorman-esque in its tone. So that was really fun. Didn't sell a lot of copies. Didn't think it would. It was more for me. And that's, again, another great gift of what I do, is that I've written something that when I'm dead and buried, my son will have this book that tells him all about how I felt about him. And that's, there's so many parts of this job that aren't to do with money, and you couldn't ask for a better family job. You know, it's I was the only bloke there today at Slimming World when I went with my wife, because we're losing weight, you know, and all the other blokes are at work, and you know, I'm with my wife and I've dropped my kids off somewhere, and it's wonderful. If you do want to buy my books, I'd say probably start with The Gates, which is my most popular series. There's four books in that at the moment. Search Ian Rob Wright on Amazon. I'm generally exclusive to Amazon, unfortunately. But if you go on my website, ianrobwright.com, you can get five of my books for free, and that's on any device. So if you on iTunes, usually, for your books and things, you can put them on there. And here's my first nonfiction book. It's a draft copy, so there's a band across the top, but ignore that. That's me and my son, Jack. It's a funny read, hopefully, anyway. And it's probably the book I've had the most enjoyment writing. And again, whatever job gives you the option to just try something completely different for a bit of fun.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Ian. That was great.
Thanks, Joanna.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Ian Rob Wright today. And I do love how focused he is and his great insights into what it takes to be a successful indie author right now in 2019 as we talk. And next week, I'm very excited because I did this interview a few weeks ago, and now bringing it to you, we're talking about audiobooks for authors with Will from Findaway Voices. And I'm super excited to share this interview. I know you're going to get lots of tips and lots of inspiration about where the audiobook market's going, what opportunities you have, and generally we geek out on audio next week. And also, if you would like to sort out your email marketing, come and join me and ConvertKit, Issa from ConvertKit, on the February the 19th. You can sign up at thecreativepen.com/feb19, FEB19. Links in the show notes as ever. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.